Hi everyone, this is episode 2 of the Vulnerabilities podcast, where we talk about those segments of society which need us the most. As always, I'm here with Marvi Maiman, former social protection minister from Pakistan, twice parliamentarian and international humanitarian. Today we will be discussing the issue of early marriages, how they have plagued the very essence of our social fabric forever, and what is being done to ensure that our children are not married off before the international adult age of 18 years worldwide. Ms. Maiman has been at the forefront of this struggle to make 18 years the legal minimum age for marriages in Pakistan and has tremendous on-ground experience on the challenge of managing such an international humanitarian commitment in a traditional, often conservative society. She introduced a legislation in 2014 in the Federal National Assembly of Pakistan, opening a national debate on this controversial subject. This paved the way for similar provincial legislation to see the light of day in Pakistan. Since then, she has been championing the cause both nationally and internationally. Before I welcome her to today's podcast, let us just define what we mean by early marriage, child marriage, and forced marriages. These can all be used interchangeably, but all refer to a practice where children, and especially girls, are married off at an earlier age than the internationally recognized age of 18. Early marriage affects both young girls and boys, although it does affect girls disproportionately. A very warm welcome to you, Ms. Maiman, on today's podcast, and thank you so much for agreeing to share your personal struggle on tackling this issue. Let me start by just asking you, what are some of the main drivers of child marriages as you have seen them on the ground?
Thank you, Laila. Indeed, early marriages are an important subject worthy of some serious reflection, since as you are well aware, they've plagued our children, and especially our girls, for far too long. So having seen it from a very close on-ground situation, at least in Pakistan, and I can safely share with you that there are a few key drivers behind this age-old practice. Fact is that there are many social, economic, cultural, political, legislative factors which interact together to result in these underage marriages. These include poverty, family honor, social norms, religious laws, lack of education, which permit the actual practice of early marriage. Now, this lack of education on the part of the parents is that early marriage will provide a certain type of protection to girls in traditional societies. And this is what drives these parents who drive there to marry their children off before the internationally acceptable 18 adult age as such. In the case of early marriage for girls, which is obviously more common than early marriages for boys, though that also exists, the matter is rooted in this perception, which is obviously a wrong perception, that women are somehow inferior to men, that they can be possessed, owned, controlled, or bought for the pleasure or upon the preference and will of men. Now, this deep-rooted gender inequality perception leads many to believe that girls are a burden on their parents. And in low-income countries, conflict-driven countries, and this is where poverty is more acute, this is often more so the case. And in these cases, parents are eager to marry off a young girl to rid their family of an extra responsibility, an extra body to feed as such. It shifts the responsibility of the girl's upbringing, the financial commitments this entails, like food, clothing, education, onto the person she's about to marry. Now, poverty is, like you've seen, a main driver of child marriages. To marry off one's daughter is often seen as a way to secure family's financial future. And this is often a price associated with such marriages, where the boy's family must pay a bride price. So it's almost like it's a price on the girl. And so it's an earning. It's an extra income for these vulnerable families, unfortunately. And it is often seen as a welcome extra income. In other cases, the dowry of such girls, if they're young, is less. They're young and less educated. So inevitably, parents would want, in certain cases, to marry them off early so that they actually pay less in terms of dowry. And both these practices are obviously considered wrong, but they're very prevalent in these societies. Another driver of early marriage, Laila, is a moral policing issue. Now, early marriage is seen as a way to curb a young girl's sexuality. It is often considered an easy route to ensure that the girls don't engage in any promiscuous behavior which may be obviously socially frowned upon. And this kind of, then again, like the education side, this kind of puts the responsibility of the moral policing onto the husband, because then she's the husband's responsibility per se, and the parents therefore then don't have that responsibility on their head. The other factor is the role of honor, or the, I would say rather, the distorted perception of honor as such. And girls involved in relationships prior to marriage are seen to bring dishonor to their parents. So just to, you know, so that the girls don't get a reputation of such dishonor, the parents prefer to get rid of them as such before this shameful quote-unquote activity takes place. And last but not the least, tradition is also a common driver for early marriages. And of course, we're going to discuss religion later on, but tradition in the sense that before the girls start their first menstruation, so when they hit puberty, that's when traditionally they are conceived as becoming women. And if they're conceived as becoming women, then of course, then it's natural that they should become wives and mothers. And then it, as a consequence, then it's natural that they should be obviously married off the minute that they hit puberty as such. So this is the traditional aspect of it.
Okay, so that's a really comprehensive overview of kind of the multifaceted drivers of child marriages. What about the question of whether this has attracted international attention? Do you think that this has indeed become a global challenge which the international community must commit to mitigating?
Yeah, I think it has become an international challenge. I'll give you an example of the SDGs which are associated with it. For example, SDG 5, achieve gender equality and empower all women and girls. Under target 5.3 of this SDG, says eliminate all harmful practices such as child, early and forced marriages and female genital mutilation. So it's pretty clear cut. There's no confusion there. It's a part of the goals of the international community. And since it's part of the goals, it's been monitored, it's been tracked for improvement, it's there. Now, at the outset, the marriage before the age of 18 is a fundamental violation of human rights. The international community has seen it, has said it, and has projected it. There's no two ways about that one. And girl child brides often feel disempowered because early marriages leave them isolated with limited freedom. Like I said earlier, they have less access to education and less access to healthcare if they get married early. I just want to go through a few statistics right now at this particular stage in the podcast so that we understand why this is such a life-threatening situation for girls who are, you know, who get married early, why it's so life-threatening. Now, the statistics show that girls under the age of 15 are 5 times more likely to die during childbirth as compared to women in their 20s. So this is very clear-cut. In addition to this, children born to young girls are also at greater risk. And the data shows that children of child brides are 60% more likely to die in the first year of their life. Again, this data is undeniable. It's clear-cut. Now, young girls are also often unable to negotiate safe sexual practices in their marriages, which then, of course, increases their risk of contracting HIV. And how can, of course, we expect a child to be aware of the unsafe sexual practices and not just aware, but also be able to, if the child bride is aware of it, how are we going to expect her to take a stand on such an issue if she's so young in front of her husband, etc. The other global challenge is that child brides are also more prone to suffering domestic violence. Now, they're often inducted in this household as perhaps second, third, fourth wives, juniors in status, and they're practically treated as domestic servants. And so the kind of domestic violence that they go through, whether it's at the behest of the senior wife or the in-laws or the husband himself, it's very acute, and it's often it's out there, and everyone has been discussing this issue of domestic servants being brought in the form of early marriages as such. Now, child marriages hamper girls' development, and it limits, like I said, their access to education, and of course they have no financial security, and if they have no education, they're going to have no professional opportunities, no financial security for later. Now, if you turn this around, you look at it from the groom's point of view, if it's a child groom as such, imagine how that child groom is going to be able to
have to provide for his child bride. So it puts a pressure on the boy as well if the boy has been married off early as well. So it works both ways as such.
Okay, so it's clearly been recognized internationally, but would you say that we can safely assume that this practice is truly global and not restricted to just certain vulnerable zones, for instance, in South Asia or other parts of the so-called developing world?
Well, it's global in the true sense because it cuts across borders, cultures, religions. It's there in the Middle East, it's there in Latin America, Europe, Sub-Saharan Africa, Asia, South Asia. But obviously, it goes without saying that where there's more traditional societies or where there's more poverty, it's going to hit more. Or where, even in Europe, if it's like the forced marriage issue has come up, where there's traditional societies living in Europe, from perhaps other continents, having a history from other continents, and they're going to be plagued with this issue as such. Now, child marriage is, like I said, it's more developing sector related, but developing countries related, but it can happen where elsewhere as well. The UNICEF data on this basically says that about 45% of all women between the ages of 20 to 24 in South Asia reported being married before the age of 18. Now, South Asian numbers, as per the UNICEF data, are pretty high. And in the last data analysis carried out by the UN on the subject, the top 20 countries with the highest rates of child marriages were Niger at 76%, the Central African Republic at 68%, Bangladesh is 59%, Brazil at 36%, Guatemala at 30%, Mexico 26%. But like I said, this data is slightly old. It's not 2020. So this number can be changing from time to time, but it gives you an idea that it's not just in one specific continent as such. And if I just share some more statistics with you for you to understand how bad the situation is, as per the UN, 37,000 girls under the age of 18 are married off daily. And one in five girls in the world are supposed to be married before the age of 18. One in nine girls in the developing world are married before the age of 15. And there are about 650 million women alive today who were married as children. So as a consequence, if you look at this trend, and if we're going to go ahead with these numbers, then about 140 million girls can be expected to be married off before the age of 18 in the next couple of years as such. Now, these are pretty large numbers. So it's a global epidemic in the making as such, which clearly a lot of effort needs to be continued to be put in to arrest this global epidemic.
Wow, those numbers are extremely staggering. Just they really put into perspective the scale of the problem. So considering the reality that this sort of data reflects, do you think that this is sufficiently recognized in international law?
Yeah, I think it is, because it's child marriage is a clear violation of human rights as per many international obligations and regional treaties. Now, I'll just take a few names for you to understand that it's out there. It's, for example, it's there in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's there in the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women's, the famous CEDAW. It's there in the Convention on Consent to Marriage. It's there in the Minimum Age for Marriage and Registration of Marriage, the same convention. Is there in the Convention on the Rights of the Child? If you look at the regional side, for example, on the Protocol on the Rights of Women in Africa to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights, also known as the Maputo Protocol, it's there in the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child. So it's there on the international side, it's there on the regional treaty side, it's definitely out there. There's no two ways about it.
Okay, and what about the national side? Are there restrictions within countries addressing a minimum legal age for marriage?
Yeah, that's where, it gets very complicated. Now, national legislations do mostly cover it, and it's important for any given country that they need to have some form of a minimum age for marriage so that they can save their children from abuse, harm, violence, exploitation, sexual exploitation. And most countries do have age restrictions by law. According to these, the minimum age for marriage is generally should be 18, but obviously not everywhere. I mean, if we take Afghanistan as an example, it's 16. And if we go on, we'll see that as per the Equality Now 2010, the report, I want to give you a few examples from there. There are countries which require consent for 18 years or above. Now, those countries, and that's the first band. There are three bands in this data. Let's go through them band by band. The first band is those Asian countries which require consent for 18 years or above. And those are Vietnam, Taiwan, Oman, Iraq, Cambodia, Bangladesh, Bhutan, China, Mongolia, Singapore, and Tajikistan. And this list has some Islamic countries, which is noteworthy, clearly showing that they have reconciled their Islamic laws within their country context. The second band is slightly more problematic because it is the 18 years of age, but with the exceptions. In this band, the countries have three types of exceptions, those that require parental consent, those who differentiate between the civil laws and Mohammedan laws, and those which require civil court consent. And finally, the third band is obviously the most worrying because these countries have different ages defined below 18 years of age or none at all. And meaning here is where the Muslim law is prevailing. And the types of age limits are interesting. Yemen, no consent or age limit. Uzbekistan, 17, but 16 under special circumstances. Thailand, 17, but 13 with parental consent. Syria, 17, but 13 with judicial consent. Saudi Arabia, no consent or age. Qatar, 16. Papua New Guinea, 16 and 14 under special circumstances. Pakistan, 16. Malaysia, 16, but under 16 with court consent. Lebanon, depends on the religion. South Korea, 16. North Korea, 17. Israel, 17, but 14 with parental consent. Iran, 16, but 13 with parental consent. Brunei, 14. Bahrain, 15. Azerbaijan, 17. Armenia, 17. Now, the above age consent country analysis presents a couple of serious issues in this entire debate. First, the countries which are Muslim are not deciding as per any religious mandate, but as per their historic tradition. Now, as per Islamic law, there is no gray on the matter. The age a girl can get married is once she reaches puberty. And there is little debate on this particular issue for fear of blasphemy charges. Let's be very clear. And of course, the example given is, peace be upon him, the Prophet's young wife, Hazrat Khadija, and that's often given as an example. So no discussion on that as such. Second, the consent number is not 18 years of age in most cases, which is problematic because there's no recognition of adulthood in these country civil laws. And this is something legislators are busy trying to fix in these countries, despite the blasphemy threats as such. Now, what seems entirely paradoxical in this debate is the dichotomy between Islamic law and the civil law in the Muslim countries discussed above, which is why the on-ground situation is not even reflective of the numbers quoted. Firstly, there's no way of making sure that the civil law minimum ages are being adhered to, since within the Islamic law, puberty is the age. Now, if anyone has an issue with that, and they wish to raise it, they can get into serious trouble with the clerics. And a lot of people would not want that for fear of, blasphemy charges. Secondly, of course, these countries, you might be aware, the birth certificates are lacking. So if a child is born, how do you know when they were born? If you don't know the age, how do you establish minimum age? So it's very difficult to implement this. And of course, these things only the time that these cases actually do get reported are on media, etc., are when below puberty marriages take place. That's when it gets highlighted. That's when it catches media attention. When it's so clear that it's a really small child and it's a really big man out there as a husband. I mean, visually you can see it. But like I said, these marriages take place to. So older men do catch the attention of media a lot more. And then there's the problem is that some of these early marriages or child marriages, they take place as a result of tribal jirga punitive action against these families. So child brides are sometimes used as punishment or payment for family feuds. And family feuds are resolved as a way of giving this price of a child bride, which is quite, I mean, it's even tough to even talk about it, but that's an on-ground reality in traditional societies. And we have faced that. We've seen that from close up. Now, when you look at these Muslim countries, which go against the puberty, which is in direct conflict with their Islamic law, it is problematic as such. And the, if you look at the gray areas, the struggle to get 18 years minimum legislation might seem like an exercise in vain, but it's not. The child bride issue is an evolutionary process. You have to see it as part of a larger process, that we have made progress on this. So now that the push for legislation is finally seeing the light of day in these countries, mostly it's because of international commitments, let's face that. It's the INGOs, the NGO campaigns that bring these issues into national parliament agenda, into the media's agenda. So we must believe in the power of creating an enabling environment for a behavioral change alongside the legislative change. And I think, Laila, if the bottom line is not just a legislation, the bottom line is that even if you do have a legislation, like I said, how are you going to enforce it, or how are you going to even monitor it or track it? You need to have a behavioral change. You need to explain to people that if you're going to get your child married off at an early age, the child is going to suffer health consequences, psychological consequences, and the child's child is going to suffer it as well. So that behavioral change is the only way forward. Of course, legislation helps as a consequence.
I think that analysis, especially the tension, or I suppose perceived tension, between Islamic law and international standards, and as well the tribal societies and things like that, would to some extent reflect your own experience in Pakistan. I'd love to just get a sense of what you encountered on your journey with legislation so that our listeners can just get a clear picture of the reality on the ground.
Yes, Lala. I introduced the minimum age restricting early marriage legislation in Pakistan in 2014-15. And I was convinced that looking at our treaty obligations and also many Muslim states' legislations on the same, I thought I wouldn't have a problem because I was speaking from the treasury benches at the time, and I thought I'd have an edge because of that as well. So one was treaty obligations, two was other Muslim countries which had minimum 18 years of legal age, which I thought was obviously going to help me in my expose at the committee. And third, of course, the fact that I was sitting on the treasury benches. Now, none of the above helped because to my surprise, when the debate started in the parliamentary committee, I got blocked by the Muslim clerics of the Council of Islamic Ideology. And when they threatened potential blasphemy charges if I did not withdraw the bill, I mean, the choice was mine. It was, either I was going to go ahead and be charged for blasphemy or I was going to have to withdraw the bill. So I at that point, I calculated, and I think I'm very happy with that decision. It was a strategic retreat. I took the bill back. But later, it helped. This particular decision helped because it gave momentum to the debate on media on this issue. And soon after that, a provincial assembly, which I'm extremely proud of, Sindh, my own province, was able to pass that required legislation. They were lucky. They had not invited the Muslim clerics in that particular meeting, so they were not threatened as such. And so one province, at least in the country, has that 18 years of minimum age. So as you can see through my own personal experience, we made progress as a whole. We still await national legislation on the issue, but the strategic retreat did help, and it started a debate on the subject, and it made other people a bit more bold on the subject. And later, when and how we wage on an attack on, you know, real, that the issue is that we need to, you know, really wage an attack on the behavioral side. And that's what I learned out of this, that we need to concentrate on the public perceptions on the behavioral side more than anything else. And that, added with that, the legislative side will give us our way forward. I think we're doing okay for the moment as a country. We need to really push for that behavioral change, and we should be on the right trajectory as such.
So clearly it is an extremely sensitive issue to tackle, and you must definitely, I'd say, move with caution with things like you said, a strategic retreat and such. From your analysis, though, it is looking like even with legal frameworks, international, regional as well, these child marriages still continue around the world. So why do you think that is, and what can be done to overcome these inadequacies?
Yeah, I think now we're coming to the solution side of the debate. Based on my experience, I've come to certain conclusions I'd like to share on the podcast today. I'm proposing a 7-point action plan against this problem. This is based on my own personal experience. And I've been talking about this internationally as well, the 7-point action plan. First, what is clear from the data that we have shared on the podcast that there's an inherent tension between official legislation and customary and religious law. And in the developing world and within conservative societies, the latter tends to take precedence. A certain level of standardization is therefore needs to be worked towards to ensure that there's no discrepancy and that customs and religious ideas do not take precedence over the legal commitments of a state to protect the rights of their children. And there needs to be a marked movement towards accountability in cases of non-compliance on this issue. Second, child marriages are deeply rooted in societal perceptions of gender and the apparently innate inferiority of women. And because of this, it's often difficult to completely override age-old understandings of gender roles and norms. Thus, education and information dissemination is crucial to inform the masses of the dangers and injustices of these practices. At the same time, capacity building is required for girls, and they must be given access to education and some personal growth so that they become a bit more financially independent. Third, the laws on the age of marriage are contradictory and are inconsistent. To counter this, really, the legal age of marriage for both boys and girls should be 18, and all legal systems should be coordinated to adopt this standard. Fourth, like I mentioned earlier, the civil registration systems are inefficient. This is particularly common in rural areas where you don't even know the age of the children, and it's difficult to assess that. So for this, you need to devote specific resources on the infrastructure and the training of the local authorities to ensure that there's a birth register, that birth register is digitized, and that there's a centralized system with this particular data, and that there's a solid database on the ages of the children. Five, the view of different religions and cultures are often misinterpreted, because religion is such a personal and often controversial area of discussion to enter into. So room must be made for respectful intellectual dialogue between different government actors, lawyers, activists, religious scholars, to clarify the we need to be clear that no religion can truly promote any suffering of any child as a result of any kind of marriage as such. So suffering no religion would allow. So the suffering side of it needs to be talked about so that all religions can be on the same wavelength on this particular issue. And on child protection systems, there's an inadequacy on that. Now, we have seen that child marriages are more common, like I said, in the rural side, and there's an absence, there's an inefficient legal aid system over there. So governments must be conscious about investing in these areas. And governments can only be conscious once the legislation is in place. So child protection systems, I have also been part of those child protection system legislations back home. And I've seen the progress that at least my country has made, and I'm sure other countries are also making on the same. Seven, finally, children are unable to take their causes to court due to their age, lack of knowledge, and agency. And so the local legal authorities need to be trained on the specificities of child marriages and gender-based violence, especially where these cases are very, very, acute as such.
Okay, and for our final question, I just wanted to pick up on something you mentioned earlier. You referred to tackling and overcoming this issue of child marriages as a process of evolution. And I just think that perfectly sums up this current moment that we're living through, where there's these waves of social movements looking to create some sort of lasting positive change. And it seems that we're just living this moment where masses are looking to be a part of something truly meaningful. So given that we already have this momentum, how do you think that one could rally more people around this cause specifically?
So the good news on that, Laila, is that the rallying is actually already happening. And there are many amazing initiatives world over. UNICEF, UN Women, UNFPA, there's an organization called Girls Not Brides, and that I'm particularly familiar with, and I'm very pleased to see their work on this. And there's some other regional initiatives as such also. So they're out there. That's the good news. Now, there are two areas I wish to emphasize going forward in the struggle to end early marriages. I think we need to kind of shift focus from statistics. I've been talking a lot about statistics as well But if we talk about faces versus statistics, number one, that's important. I think if you look at, you know, how many ways, if people were to hear the individual stories versus just the statistics, it would hit them a little bit more. Especially those people with the authority to initiate change, it might be more effective in cultivating a sense of empathy with them and sensitivity towards the plight of these children. I just want to give you an example of a girl from Afghanistan. And for the sake of her privacy, her name has been changed, and we will call her Farishta in this particular case. And that's how she's been referred to. She was 12 when she was married off, and she was married off to a man in his 60s as such. And Farishta's father married his daughter off. For 3 years, she was forced to live with this husband of hers without seeing her parents. And she was physically abused. She then became pregnant with the man's child, and she was diagnosed with postpartum psychosis after giving birth to a son. Farishta was ultimately recovered by her mother, who managed to find her. And she was taken to UNFPA Family Protection Facility or treatment. She now lives with her mother and her child in the Herat province in Afghanistan. Now, Farishta hopes to be a teacher one day. Now, when we talk about individuals, like the example I've just given you, and when you understand the mental and physical abuse that so many Farishtas have gone through as a result of forced and early marriages, then I think it hits home more. And then behavioral changes are possible in societies. Now, of course, her aspirations have been dashed. There's no way such children can live innocent. I mean, these are innocent children. And it's really an accident of birth that they're born to parents who have subjected them, who have allowed such torture to happen to them. Because if a child is married off as a child, it's not the child's decision. It's the parents' decision. Though, of course, the good news on the Islamic side is that you need to give consent, that the child needs to say yes. But a child is a child at the end of the day. So, those are really tricky issues that, yes, as per religion, the consent is important. But whose consent are we talking about? We're talking about a child's consent here. So without consent, frankly, that marriage is not even possible. That's the good news on that side. But anyway, so coming back to this issue, we need to create champions, I believe. We need to create media champions, legislative champions, human rights activist champions, students champions, victims champions. It's a collective voice of all these champions brought together under one platform, which can create the right momentum in the struggle. So that's on the first part of the first prong of it, I believe. And the second prong of it is that at the UN level, at the international level, at the United Nations Secretary General level, or the heads of states level, it's very important that their statements on this particular issue, which have been coming, which we have been seeing, that they continue. Of course, those statements will continue, but what's important is that the data sharing between states using the UN mechanism must be accelerated. That from one country to the other, you need to learn from each country's hits and misses. If there's a collective approach to this problem, I feel that we'll do better. And nobody should feel alone in the struggle, because like I said, it's a global issue. It's not just related to one country. It's not you can't just say it's a religious issue, because it's not related to one religion. It's across the board. And in the final analysis, everyone must unite. So the champion must unite. The countries must unite on the data sharing, on their experiences. And only then will we be able to, you know, save our children from this issue. Because really, it's a question of saving children. You save a child, you save their whole future. It's not small. And like I said, the numbers of how many child brides are going to be out there in the next decade, the numbers in millions, and it is, if you look at it, it's very big, but it can be handled. It can be handled through better legislation. It can be handled through behavioral change. It can be handled through us getting together now versus tomorrow.
I think that's definitely a most apt way to end this episode. I think ultimately, when dealing with issues like this, we need to, like you said, move forward with a sense of humility and just really recognize how easily it could be any one of us facing these sorts of vulnerabilities. I truly hope this episode has helped to like shed light on the issue of child marriages so that we can cultivate a sense of empathy and compassion and ultimately turn that into tangible, effective responses to save the lives of these vulnerable children. Thank you so much, Ms. Maiman, for sharing your time with us again today. I look forward to chatting with you again soon.
Thank you.